coming up this hour, we welcome new insight into the way Americans and South Dakotans handled COVID-19 mitigation efforts. We'll talk about the science and the ideology, the leadership, and the Constitution. First up, we welcome University of South Dakota School of Law Professor Emeritus Frank Pommersheim. He'll address the consistency of Governor Noem's policies and ask whether her approach had the balance of public health emergency required. Then USD School of Law Dean Neil Fulton joins us. We'll talk about constitutional culture and what happens when the individual can veto, overrule public policy. Plus, Moment in Sound with Casey Hughes, poetry from Studio 47. News is next.
With SDPB News, I'm John Wynn. Lawmakers are updating the current state budget and finalizing numbers for the next fiscal year. This year's spending will go down by $167 million. Representative Chris Carr is the co-chair of the Appropriations Committee. He says the drop in spending does not require a cut in programs, largely because of money from the federal government.
We had the coronavirus relief fund dollars that came in last year. We were able to utilize those for a lot of the state's needs and cover expenses, but we also were able to save some general funds in that process.
Lawmakers approved $50 million for a needs-based college scholarship program, a longtime Democratic priority. They also approved $100 million for broadband expansion and $5 million for a new state airplane. Republican State Senator Jean Hunoff says this year was an appropriations year like she's never seen before. The state will spend $1.8 billion in general funds, $1.8 billion in federal funds, and $1.4 billion in other funds.
Totaling $5.1 billion in total funds. That is an awful lot of dollars, but with those dollars, we're going to do great things for the people of South Dakota.
The big three, education, state employees, and community service providers, will see a 2.4% inflationary increase in pay. Governor Kristi Noem says she's weighing whether to sign a bill that would ban transgender girls and women from female sports leagues. Transgender advocates demonstrated at the Capitol, and college athletes pressured the NCAA to punish states that pass such laws. Shortly after the legislature passed the bill Monday, the Republican governor said she was excited to sign it, but at a news conference on Thursday, she struck a more cautious tone. While Noem argues the bill is about protecting women's sports, her decision to sign it into law could have far-reaching effects. The Air Force is one step closer to making South Dakota's Ellsworth Air Force Base the first home of a new stealth bomber. The B-21 is currently under development and scheduled to start flying sometime this decade. A recently published environmental impact statement affirms Ellsworth as the preferred location for the first operational planes. U.S. Senator John Thune of South Dakota says that's good news.
Now all we have to wait for is the final record of decision, but we think the base is extremely well positioned for the B-21 mission and are encouraged by the findings in the EIS and the conclusions that were drawn there.
Thune expects a final decision this spring or summer. The B-21s will gradually replace the existing B-1 bombers at Ellsworth. A home base for the new generation of stealth planes could add 3,000 people to the area. The base received more good news recently when South Dakota lawmakers approved $3.2 million to help build a fitness and recreation center near the base in Box Elder. The South Dakota Department of Tourism and State University Extension are working together to create opportunities by combining the two largest industries in the state, agriculture and tourism. They've created an agritourism program for farm, ranch owners, and others who want to connect tourists with agriculture and help them see where local food and beverages come from. Extension field specialist Peggy Schlechter says people don't have the connection with agriculture that they used to when their grandparents might have owned a farm or ranch. The two-year extension program focuses on providing the tools and skills needed to develop a successful agritourism enterprise. Coming up next, it's In the Moment on South Dakota Public Broadcasting.
In the 1890s, Wilmington, North Carolina had a thriving black middle class, a large black electorate, and black representatives in local government. But that ended in 1898 with a bloody campaign of violence and intimidation by white supremacists. On the next Fresh Air, journalist David Zucchino talks about his new book, Wilmington's Lie. Join us.
Tonight at 7 Central, 6 Mountain on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Yak Ridge Cabins and Farmstead. Your year-round Black Hills adventure awaits with private cabins, modern amenities, and Himalayan yaks. Social distance stays minutes from Mount Rushmore and Hill City. More at yak-ridge.com.
From the Big Sioux and Big Stone Lake to the Buttes and Badlands, South Dakota Public Broadcasting is bringing people together, creating events, telling stories, building community. You can play a part in guaranteeing that SDPB serves the state for years to come. Listen for information about our Sound Vision campaign coming in April.
Program funding is provided by SDN Communications. Even the wireless revolution needs a lifeline, and SDN is happy to provide 50,000 miles of broadband fiber support. More at SDNCommunications.com.
Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. 1 year after COVID-19 was first detected in South Dakota, we look back at the response here in the state. Where did we succeed? Where did we fall short? For some, it might be tempting to say that South Dakota forged a new path through the pandemic, one that passionately preserved individual freedoms. Or it might be tempting to look at the death rate per capita, so far one of the highest in the nation, and say that we failed, and in a devastating way. Of course, it's more nuanced than that. Frank Pommersheim is an author, a poet, and professor emeritus from the University of South Dakota School of Law. He has written about Governor Kristi Noem's response, and he joins us today with some insight. Frank, welcome back to In the Moment. It's nice to have you again.
Good to be here. Thank you, Lori.
I want to start us up with a little clip from Governor Kristi Noem talking on the anniversary week of COVID-19 in the state about the response of her office. And here is a little something about what she said about her role during the pandemic. Take a listen.
I think a leader tells the truth. You spoke of that earlier in your monologue. They're in search of justice and that they know that ultimately the buck stops with them.
A little bit, Frank, that you have written about her leadership, how she modeled things, the policies that she enacted. So let's unpack a little bit of this. Do you think that she lacked balance in her overall response?
Well, for me, she did. I would sort of step back for a moment and talk about leadership, because I think given the notion of COVID-19 kind of coming out of nowhere across the country, it kind of posed a challenge for leadership all across this country and at every level. And so to me, it raises the interesting question about what is leadership, particularly in the context of some unexpected huge problem. And in thinking about it, I would think about leadership in that kind of a context is to heal division and bring people together as they face, in this case, as they face the pandemic of COVID-19.
And so much of the information. Go ahead.
Well, so for me, in that kind of context, did the governor do this? And to me, it seemed like she wasn't about healing division and trying to bring people together.
Early on, there was, you know, the information for this, as you say, it was largely unexpected. Certainly, the state of South Dakota had a flu pandemic plan. You know, authors have written about pandemics, so it's not like it was outside our imagination or some planning that there could be a widespread contagion. But the level of this, I think, really hit fast, and it was confusing and hard to follow. Often the science was emerging very quickly. Early on, Governor Kristi Noem canceled basketball tournaments, required schools to close for a week of cleaning, held daily press conferences, asked the healthcare organizations to work together to, you know, bump up capacity, hospital capacity, make those plans. And then later the policy shifted somewhat to more back to normal, open for business, let's go forward. Where do you see the success of some of that and then some of the failures?
Well, for me, in terms of thinking about this, this is largely a public health issue and what is to be the response of government at all levels dealing with this sort of public health issue. And I think the starting point, and it is emerging, is what does the science tell us about what is arguably the best possible public response. And my understanding was that more and more the public health approach was, at a minimum, that people should be encouraged to wear masks and keep social distance. In fact, the South Dakota State Medical Association stated that. It believes this, I'm quoting here, believes the state must do more, and we continue our call for more aggressive measures to help stop the spread of COVID-19. We urge the governor to issue a statewide mask mandate, and in the current absence of a statewide mandate, we urge local government ordinances to require mask wearing. And I think that clearly was the recommendation from the public health community. And as far as I can tell, the governor went in a completely different direction.
Yeah. How much of that was, the policy itself, and how much of it was modeling? You know, what did we see with her? And I don't remember seeing her wearing a mask until November, when she was at an event with veterans and she said, you know, I'm modeling when you should wear a mask. But almost every picture we saw of her from the 4th of July beyond, she was maskless.
Yes, I think that's true. And so she seemed not to be following or modeling what the public health community was strongly recommending.
Yeah.
And I'm not sure what the thinking was there, but I think that's the message that she seemed to be communicating.
Yeah. You mentioned health policy officials and whether or not they were, you know, listened to with some of those, requests, especially for mask wearing. What about other, state judiciary or, you know, other people who are calling for a different, more nuanced approach? Tell me a little bit about that.
Well, my thinking is, and you mentioned the word and her commitment to justice, and I think that's definitely laudable. But the key is how you define justice. And for me, when I think about justice, particularly in this kind of context, that it's an ongoing conversation about safety, fairness, and communal well-being leavened with compassion. And it has to be an inclusive conversation. And my question is, was this conversation ongoing? Was the governor seeking input, just conversation, showing respect from tribal communities in South Dakota about dealing with the issue of the pandemic? Was she seeking input directly from the public health community, not only in the state of South Dakota, but nationally? Was she observing what was happening with the state judiciary? And to me, it seemed from afar, just speaking as a citizen, that there wasn't this kind of ongoing conversation about what was best for to achieve safety, fairness, and communal well-being in our state, all leavened with kind of compassion. This was a very difficult situation. There's no doubt about it. And I'm unaware that these kind of conversations were actually ongoing.
Say more about the state judiciary. What do you mean by that? Some of the actions taken by Chief Justice David Gilbertson, for example.
Well, Chief Justice Gilbertson, as he has the right under state law, he declared a state of judicial emergency. And that was unquestioned, and that provided the opportunity for each circuit in the state to decide how they would deal with their docket, how they would deal with what steps should be taken in the context of using the courthouse. Mm-hmm. And I think that was sort of evidence of a recognition of the seriousness of the problem that exists in the state.
I also want to go back to something you said just now about compassion. And one of the things I remember early on was that Governor Noem would say in her press conferences, you know, we're going to listen to the science, we're going to listen to the facts, we're not going to be emotional about this. And I want to get to that notion of compassion and emotion and honoring what has been lost. And is there, do you think that she has done enough to acknowledge adequately the more than 1,900 people who have died? What would that look like to, you know, what would that look like publicly to say more needs to be done to acknowledge those lives?
Sure. I think she has acknowledged those numbers, and that's a good thing because those are the facts. In thinking about this, it's like whenever a society suffers some unbelievable loss, usually that society, both privately and acting through its government, tries to provide and create memorials to the fallen. And so in the context of the pandemic, I would encourage the governor to think about some kind of memorial to the fallen in South Dakota, those plus 180,000 people who have died as a result of the pandemic.
1,900.
The pandemic has killed more people in South Dakota than any other event in the past 100 years. And so the idea of some kind of a memorial that the governor and or the legislature to issue a proclamation just to recognize that loss and what an incredible loss it is to the state and to pay tribute to those folks, to the fallen, to those people who have died. To have a
1,907 is our deaths among cases today, and I suspect that work is not done either. Frank, tell me a little bit about, because as you write about this COVID response, you also have written about the way the governor and the state legislature dealt with Amendment A and initiated Measure 26, which were both voter-approved measures regarding marijuana. Tell me how these two topics are connected.
I definitely want to do that, Lori. But in context, I just want to double back to the notion of a memorial. I think it's important for governments to acknowledge what has happened, to provide an opportunity for us publicly to remember and hold dear all those people that we have lost. So the possibility of a proclamation, a public moment of silence, the American flag and the South Dakota flag at half-mast, I think those are important things to be thinking about to ensure that this great loss remains with us, that we continue to honor the fallen in that particular context. Yeah. In the context of dealing with the legalization of marijuana, I mean, the governor always prides herself in listening to people. And here you have the context, not only just listening to people, that people voted in South Dakota to legalize recreational marijuana and to legalize medical marijuana. And instead of that, just going forward, however difficult it might be for the governor, whatever her personal preferences might be, from what I see, she is doing everything she can to prevent that from happening. And that's the will of the people. I mean, I understand democracy to be that elected officials are to reflect what the people elected them wanted. And speaking through a constitutional amendment and an initiated measure is pretty strong evidence, a pretty strong voice of what the people of South Dakota want in those particular issues.
Frank Palmerschein
is... It's sort of complicated. We're in that situation where You have the governor issuing an executive order, including funding, so that Amendment A could be challenged. And then on the other side, you have the Attorney General, after losing at the motion level, decides he's not even going to appeal it to the South Dakota Supreme Court. So you have this incredibly important issue that the people of South Dakota have spoken very directly about, and the two highest officials in the executive branch are acting to thwart the will of the people. I find that difficult.
Frank Pommersheim is professor emeritus at the USD School of Law. He's an author and a poet and a fairly frequent guest here on the program. We look forward to talking to you next time. Thanks, Professor.
Okay, thank you.
The American debate over COVID-19 mitigation efforts quickly became saturated with words like freedom and liberty. And though we recognized the science had become politicized, we have perhaps yet to fully understand the undercurrent of that commentary and what it means for our society. Does the U.S. Constitution prohibit requiring citizens to wear face coverings during a pandemic, for example? Where is the line between right and responsibility? Neil Fulton is Dean of the University of South Dakota School of Law. He has written a new examination of the uniquely American debate over public health and constitutional culture. Dean Fulton, welcome back. Thank you for being here.
Pleasure to be here, Lori.
I want to start with these words like freedom and liberty. How soon did we start seeing words like that become central to the debate over how we would handle COVID-19 mitigation efforts or countermeasures in the U.S.? How quick was that?
You know, my recollection, Lori, and the research really indicates it happened soon, that as you started to see both local governments and private businesses impose restrictions like occupancy loads, mask requirements, you saw a lot of people pushing back on that and doing so in the language of, I have rights, I have liberty, and you're intruding on that. So I think it really kind of started as soon as the restrictions did.
And what the significance of tying that to the U.S. Constitution, to we the people, to that was that the founders' intent? Help us unpack a little bit of why that became so quickly a constitutional conversation instead of a conversation about, you know, the scope of measures and what was effective and what was ineffective.
You know, one, I think that is where we are as a society. We very much ground a lot of our disputes in legal language, in constitutional language. So that's kind of what we do as Americans, and we've done that for the longest time. I mean, Tocqueville observed that in the 1700s. But it was interesting here when you ask, was this what the framers intended? The answer is no, certainly against other private individuals, right? You saw people rejecting not only government restrictions, but restrictions imposed by other private actors like businesses, and certainly the founders didn't have anything to say about one individual imposing restrictions on their place of business versus another individual. And that was one of the things that was striking to me, is that the conversation about rights moved beyond rights against government, but rights against anyone telling us what to do.
One of the things that struck me about your piece and also, my memories of the pandemic was just there was very little room for compromise. If you didn't believe that masks should be required, that was a firm line that you would just, it wasn't about, well, where should they be required or do they work? It was just a big fat no. So talk a little bit about compromise and what's sacrificed when there is no room for compromise, when the answer is mask yes or mask no, and there's no in between.
Yeah, you know, and I would even go beyond the requirement, Lori, to say that it was whether people would voluntarily do this. I mean, one of the things that goes along with being a functioning society is having rights and exercising them in responsible ways. We saw masks as really this sign. Are you on team mask? Are you not on team mask? Would I refuse to wear a mask? Not because I didn't want the government to tell me or someone else to tell me, but just because I didn't want anyone to tell me what to do. The mask, you know, to me, unquestionably the most trivial burden and response to COVID, became a symbol of a lot of other things. And it really was this place where there was no compromise. And that is one of the points of my article, is that, you know, when you reach this point where you can't balance rights and responsibilities, when you don't compromise in our creation of public policy or even our existence in society, you are on the road to societal erosion and death. It's just unsustainable if my vision of living in society is doing exactly what I want, exactly when and how I want, vis-a-vis everyone else.
Going back to the founders, there's one line in the paper that you sent that I've shared widely, and it is this comparison of Patrick Henry's give me liberty or give me death versus give me liberty, we'll see who dies. Say more about that, specifically as it relates to someone like Patrick Henry and how that rallying cry is really misplaced in this context.
Well, you know, we love to cite the founders with good reason in the United States. They had a lot of brilliant ideas. One of them, expressed by Patrick Henry, is, I'm willing to die for this cause. Give me liberty or give me death was the demand on King George to say, we resist tyranny and I will die for this. I pledge my life, my fortune, and my sacred honor. In the context of COVID, what you saw was people who said, I don't want to wear a mask, and I'm going to go into a Target and cough on someone who is working at roughly minimum wage just to prove some point, was not anything like Henry's willingness to die for his cause. It was an assertion that everyone around me has to die for my preferences. And I realize that sounds a little bit hyperbolic, but to say that these are 180-degree views of how one lives in society and exercises responsibilities to society, not only claims rights, I don't think is an overstatement. Henry was willing to die for the cause and the people around him. That doesn't really seem like what mask resistors were willing to bring to the table.
I want to go to the idea of where do we go from here or what happens next, because I find this just really compelling. When you talk about, you know, if the individual veto can just override any kind of self-governance, then we really don't have any kind of self-governance. And you talk about how many times the front lines of this battle was a city council where, you know, people were arguing with the people they had the closest access to, you know, the mayor, the city council, the school board, what have you, and much of that, of course, made the national news. But let's talk about, because it ends, you take us to a very optimistic and hopeful but serious place in the end. What do we need to focus on going forward, as many of these things about American culture, about ourselves, have been revealed and have been in stark relief during the pandemic? Certainly not the first time we've known some of these things, but how do we refocus, and what do we refocus on?
You know, the first thing I would say, Lori, is changing our view and description of government from this sort of disembodied external force to our collective action for common good. We can really have vigorous debates about the scope of regulation, about tax and spending policy, about what makes good policy when we do choose to regulate, but I think we need to stop with the suggestion that government is some shadowy external force, when in reality it is our self-regulation as a society through our elected representatives. I think the second thing that we really need to do is, you know, you need to revisit the idea of rights balanced by responsibilities. We have very few rights that don't come in for some balancing. The right of free expression, which is one of our most fundamental rights, is balanced in some instances against, you know, what we won't tolerate in hate speech or pornography or true threats. And I think for us as citizens, weighing out how we exercise our rights through responsibility to the people around us is important. And the last thing I would say then is just this idea of common good. You know, it is very easy to assert individual preferences and desires. It is harder to sometimes sublimate those to what is the common good. And I think re-envisioning our engagement to focus on the common collective good is something that we've lost touch with a little bit and is imperative for us going forward.
We have talked so much this year and last year in the state legislative context about civics education, and you talk too about citizen education and reclaiming, you know, Republican virtues, Republican in lowercase here, character judgment and concern for that public good. This reminds me, Dean Fulton, of the idea of censorship in social media, which is a serious topic that needs to be discussed. And then I always say, and also we should be talking about what you posted, because at some point, don't we need to cultivate an online sense of virtue and character? And some of those things you maybe should have thought twice about. So talk a little bit about just how we hold one another accountable, how we educate ourselves and our kids about things like character and virtue in a swiftly changing cultural context.
Yeah, I mean, you know, going back to the founders, the founders were deeply small R Republican in the sense that they were profoundly influenced by the Roman Republic, the goal of which was to deliberate collectively towards the public good. And the idea of Republican virtue is that we structure our society and our governmental structures to advance that, to encourage people to develop the skills of deliberation, of collective self-governance. And that takes enormous work. It starts in schools. It starts with ourselves. And then going along with that, the idea of responsibility, I think, grows out of that. Do we have a right to go on to Twitter or to Facebook and say incredibly inflammatory, destructive things about another citizen? We do. Does a private vendor like Twitter or Facebook have a right to police that environment and say that some people can speak here and some people can't? They do. But I think more fundamentally, the question is, should we as private citizens temper our discussion and elevate it as opposed to drag it down? And should those forums police themselves and the discussion with the goal of elevating the debate to a more substantive, respectful, engaging place? I think we should. I don't think we do, but I think we should.
Neil Fulton is Dean of the USD School of Law. The piece is called COVID, Constitution, Individualism, and Death. Where is it being published, Dean Fulton?
It'll be published in the Widener Law Review from Delaware in April.
Thank you so much for being here with us. Look forward to talking to you next time.
Always a pleasure, Laurie. Thank you.
We'll bring you a little music up next on listener-supported SDPB Radio. You're in the moment.
This week on Science Friday, can we geoengineer our way out of human-caused natural disasters, including climate change? Author Elizabeth Colbert talks about some of the sci-fi-sounding tech solutions. Plus, Jackson, Mississippi's three-week water crisis is coming to an end, but is this just a Band-Aid solution? That's on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday beginning at 1 Central, noon Mountain, on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Missouri River Energy Services, working in partnership with our 61 member communities to provide energy and energy services that support citizens and help sustain local business. MRenergy.com.
If you've got cabin fever, you could try asking your smart speaker to beam you somewhere else, but a safer bet is asking your smart speaker to play NPR. Listening to well-told stories can help you feel transported to where the action is happening, and it keeps you feeling connected. When you want to be somewhere else but can't, try asking your smart speaker to play NPR.
SDPB is here to cover what's important to you. Just give us a shout. Ask your smart speaker to play SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Black Hills Information Security, a global IT company providing education, penetration testing, and defensive services, helping your company understand threats and building defenses, based in South Dakota, BHIS.co.
You're listening to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. Peer-based country music artist Casey Hughes calls himself a good old South Dakota boy with big dreams. Hughes has released his second album, Memories, and recently joined the show for Moment in Sound. So, Casey Hughes, welcome to In the Moment. Thanks for being here.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
Gene, welcome. Thanks for showing up.
Thank you.
Casey, let's talk with you, and to start us off, tell us a little bit about what this pandemic has been like for you, including a little bout with coronavirus yourself.
Yeah, it's, as far as the music side of things go, it's definitely made that fairly non-existent. We got to play a couple shows here, this summer, outdoor stuff, and then it went back into the wintertime and pretty much put the kibosh to that, and then I did end up getting the coronavirus here a few months back and got through that. So we've just been getting together and kind of practicing, which has really helped get my lungs back in shape after having that crud.
Yeah. I saw you on Facebook learning how to play Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star on the violin, and it just made me laugh the way you handled that whole moment. You have a good attitude, but I was worried about your singing ability. So how has that been?
Well, I noticed for sure the first about 2 months after that, I had like some long-term kind of shortness of breath when it came to when we'd get together and practice with me and the rest of the band here. And eventually, I think the singing really kind of helped get my lungs back in shape. So, if it's prolonged for somebody, I got to feel like that really helped get me back, my lungs and my breath capacity back in shape.
Yeah, it's a big deal. So we're rooting for you as we learn more about the virus and moving past it. We're going to get to some music here, but before we do, this is country music, Casey, and you stick right to some of the roots of traditional country music. Tell me some of your influences and why you love making music in South Dakota.
My influences were really heavily on my dad's side. I grew up listening to records of George Jones and Buck Owens and, Vern Gosen and stuff. And then with a little bit of rock, my mom was way into kind of rock or whatever pop would have been, Michael Jackson and stuff like that. So once in a while, some of that stuff carries over as well. But yeah.
All right. We're going to play the first song called Memories, the title cut from Casey Hughes' newest album. We'll talk to Gene Lumby as well. But first, take a listen to Memories.
Pick up every rock I see. Been doing that since I was three. Now my kids do it too. They're a lot like me. I love a fishing rod in my hand. Yes, I got that from my dad. My grandpa did too. Their first habit to have. Man, all those little memories, yeah, they always seem grown up. My horse, she's so damn tough. Got one of her own, and the times are rough. He says he wants to be just like his daddy and me. The world keeps on a turning, making memories. Mary, all those little memories, yeah, they always seem to get to me. Even when I'm down, bring me around.
You're listening to Moment in Sound on SDPB Radio. My guest, Casey Hughes, you heard the title track from his album, Memories, there. We've got Casey and Gene Lumbee, bass player, with us on the line right now. Gene, when I first started playing this music, I was like, I was not expecting that voice. I was not expecting that when I first hit play. When you hear Casey sing, tell me a little bit about the impact his voice and his delivery really has on you.
It's real. He's a talented songwriter. I've been doing the live music thing and bands and so on for nearly 40 years, and so I'm a songwriter myself. And when I hear the inspiration that comes out of his voice and his way of writing, that's as big an influence as anything to me. I've kind of somewhat remind myself of what it was like when I started out. You know, I've been doing this for almost 40 years, and so it kind of reminds me of a younger me, I guess I'd say. And so it's very, very exciting to hear anything that he comes up with. And then as a group, when we put it together and actually put music to it, it's a rush for sure.
Yeah, it's timeless in some ways. Like, this could have been, written in 1975, and it could be written today. I just love it. So, Casey, tell me about the people, the musicians that you surround yourself with, and what the process of collaboration has been to make music.
Well, we have a great band, really great group of guys, everybody here. We've got Gene Lumbee on bass, and then Dean Wallace on lead guitar, Mark Emerson on steel guitar, pedal steel rather, and Steve Van Mullum on fiddle, and Jim Hardwick on drums. And when I bring a song that I had freshly written to these guys, it really changes, small aspects when you get input from six, different musicians that are really good. A lot of them have great ears and change just little things that I didn't think of, and really bring a song together.
We're going to play Guilty Pleasures next. Tell us a little bit about this song before we hit play, Casey.
Guilty Pleasures is, I wrote this just thinking about things that I overindulge in once in a while. And my dad, he's, we talk about stuff like that a lot, just things that we overindulge in, I guess. And that was the biggest thing, whether it be drinking too much or, loving too hard, along with, I think I've got some lines of both things in there.
A perfect country song that everyone needs. Here is Guilty Pleasures.
I drink coffee until it makes me shake. I drink whiskey until I can't stay awake. And when I love, I'll take it to the grave. guilty pleasures are what are driving me insane. Guilty pleasures, oh, I take them to extremes. Oh, I drink this damn old whiskey until it turns me mean. Guilty pleasures, no, I just can't seem to quit. Oh, to kill me if I can't stop with just a little sip. Telling jokes, and I'm the one who cracks. And when I smoke, I'll burn.
Album is called Memories by Casey Hughes, and we've been talking with singer-songwriter and the bass player, Gene Lumby. Gene, thanks for being here with us today. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Casey Hughes, thanks as well.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Had some music and now some poetry. We'll take a break. Poetry from Studio 47 is up next.
I'm Carl Gerke, and this evening on Jazz Nightly, we'll hear some joyful music from trombonist Clifton Anderson's latest album. And there are tracks from composer, guitarist Lyle Workman, and New Faces, a band of emerging young artists. Plus, the Smithsonian Jazz Masterworks Orchestra plays Leonard Bernstein. And we'll dig into the vaults for classic recordings by Horace Silver and John Coltrane. You can join me at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on SDPB Radio.
Program funding is provided by Touchmark at All Saints, where life for people 55 plus means maintenance-free living, with meals, activities, and more, all close to downtown Sioux Falls, celebrating 40 years of hospitality. More at touchmark.com.
Beginning March 29th, weekday mornings on SDPB will sound a little different. starting at 9, 8 Mountain with 2 hours of 1A, followed by On Point at 11, 10 Mountain. Then join the team from In the Moment as we cover stories about South Dakota told by the people from South Dakota. It's all your favorite shows, but at new times, starting March 29th on SDPB.
Program funding is provided by the South Dakota Cultural Heritage Center in Pierre. The museum now offers free admission to South Dakota residents and children from everywhere. Coronavirus protections in place. More at 773-3458 or history.sd.gov.
Arts, literature, and music reporting on SDPB is supported by the Northern State University School of Fine Arts. More information available at northern.edu.
You're listening to In the Moment on SDPB Radio. Here is poetry from Studio 47 with Patrick Hicks.
This is poetry from Studio 47. Welcome. Today's poet is Dana Gioia. Gioia was born on December 24, 1950, in Los Angeles, California, to parents of Italian and Mexican heritage. After graduating from Junipero Serra High School, he went to Stanford University and graduated with a BA in 1973. He then went to Harvard, where he earned a master's degree in 1975. This was quickly followed by another master's from Stanford Business School in 1977. Gioia then went to work with General Foods, where he became vice president of marketing. In 1992, he left his position to pursue writing as a poet full-time. Of his love for poetry, he had this to say in an interview. "My life changed for the better by falling in love with poetry. It made me a better student, made me a more alert human being, and I'd like to try to bring the gifts of poetry to the broadest audience possible." It is safe to say that he has. His books include The Daily Horoscope, The Gods of Winter, Interrogations at Noon, Pity the Beautiful, and several books of criticism, including Can Poetry Matter?, as well as the libretti for three operas, including Nosferatu, Tony Caruso's Last Broadcast, and The Three Feathers. Gioia has won a number of awards, including the American Book Award, the Presidential Citizens Medal, the Walt Whitman Champion of Literacy Prize, as well as 10 honorary doctorates. From 2003 to 2009, he served as the chair of the National Endowment for the Arts. Under his leadership, he began the popular national program Poetry Out Loud, which offers high school students the opportunity to memorize poems, recite them for competitions, and possibly compete at the national level in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to learn more about Poetry Out Loud, it was featured on this show in episode 23. Gioia also created Operation Homecoming, Writing the Wartime Experience, which created an anthology of writing about the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. It was eventually turned into a powerful documentary that was nominated for an Academy Award. From 2015 to 2019, Gioia was the California State Poet Laureate, and he is currently the Judge Whitney Professor of Poetry and Public Culture at the University of Southern California. Today's poem is The Next Poem. What I really like about this poem is reading it aloud and hearing the rhyme scheme. The subject matter, that of writing a new poem and being hopeful that it might be good, will be familiar to anyone that writes. When you sit down to create the first draft of a poem, there is energy and possibility and hope. Our poem for today is about that moment of launching yourself into a new literary project and feeling that anything might happen, that maybe, just maybe, this idea of yours will turn into something beautiful. That's the hope, anyway. Often, though, the final version of a poem is disappointing. There is a sense that maybe you could have done it better. Thankfully, though, there is always the next poem. Maybe that's the one that will be perfect. This is The Next Poem by Dana Gioia. How much better it seems now than when it is finally done. The unforgettable first line, the cunning way the stanzas run. The rhymes, soft-spoken and suggestive, are barely audible at first. An appetite not yet acknowledged, like the inkling of a thirst. While gradually the form appears as each line is coaxed aloud, the architecture of a room seen from the middle of a crowd. the music that of common speech, but slanted so that each detail sounds unexpected as a sharp inserted in a simple scale. No jumble box of imagery dumped glumly in the reader's lap, or elegantly packaged junk the unsuspecting must unwrap, but words that could direct a friend precisely in an unknown place, those few unshakable details that no confusion can erase. And the real subject left unspoken, but unmistakable to those who don't expect a jungle parrot in the black and white of prose. How much better it seems now than when it is finally written. How hungrily one awaits to feel the bright lure seized, the old hook bitten.
Poetry from Studio 47 is hosted and curated by Patrick Hicks. This episode was recorded remotely due to the coronavirus pandemic and produced by Peter Folliard. We both send our best wishes. Thank you for listening.
And that is our show for today. Thank you for listening. We hope that it served you. On Mondays in the Moment, South Dakota lawmakers have closed the door on the 2021 legislative session, at least until veto day. We'll have a recap. For Steve Zwemke, Chris Loffrey, Josh Heyer, I'm Lori Walsh. Thank you for listening.